Huh. So the mayor of Bedford Falls didn't support me? I'll fix him. Release the flying monkeys.
Governor, there are no flying monkeys.
Uh-uh.
Ow!
Never reality check me. Anyway, I have a better idea. Do something, anything, to that town that I don't know about.
Well, we could close down there. Or we could send a state troop.
Use your judgment, okay? I don't need to know the details. And I want you to know that whatever happens, look at me, Gene.
It's Greg.
Whatever happens, I am 100% behind you. It might sound like the words coming out of my mouth are saying that you're a lying psychopath who should never work again, but that's our secret code for I'm 100% behind you. You got it, Gene?
Yes, Governor.
All right, great. Meanwhile, these people are going to listen to a radio show about what could go wrong with a plan like that. And now he believes the cones on the bridge were the same extraterrestrials who probed him, Colin McEnroe.
Well, what I believe is it's time for alternate conspiracy theories about the George Washington Bridge. So, yeah, I'm going with it. Those weren't even really rubber or orange cones. They were extraterrestrials. And because after a day or so of the kind of existing non-conspiracy theory, we're all getting a little bit bored. But not so bored that we're not going to talk about it on the nose. In fact, with our panel, I'm sure we'll find interesting directions in which to go. One of the things that Chris Christie could have done is to hire Doobie McDowell, one of our panelists, from McDowell Jewett Communications, exactly the kind of thing that they help people with, although they ideally hope you're not in that much trouble by the time you call. Teresa Kramer is also with us. She's from The Cut, an online magazine exploiting and celebrating Connecticut's ridiculousness. And Rand Cooper is with us, restaurant critic, novelist, short story writer, essay writer, and enjoyer of life, although not so much at the moment, but he may explain this as the show goes on. And so we will begin, in fact, with Bridgegate. And ordinarily on the nose, one of the things I try to do is to not talk about the story that the whole nation is talking about, because I feel like by the time you get to us, maybe you're already tired of it. Except this one's so good. This one's just so great, you know. It's just so interesting on so many different levels, and I do feel as though we can contribute very much to this. But maybe we should go to Doobie McDowell first, because this is the kind of thing that people do come to you for help with, and you probably have watched all or some, I don't know if you had time to watch all of Chris Christie's press conference yesterday. It did stretch across a couple of hours.
It was almost as long as Wolf of Wall Street.
Exactly. In general, how did he do?
I think he did as well as he could have under the circumstances, and they are lousy circumstances. Though what I would have advised him to do is to have talked less about himself.
Mm-hmm.
It was all about him, and I'm embarrassed, and I'm sad, and I'm humiliated. I think he should have talked more about the people he inconvenienced and put in danger as well.
And I mean, obviously also, as we know from having covered these things in the past and perhaps your involvement on the other side of the line these days, the most important conversation is the one that took place before the press conference. And it was a long conversation, we have to assume. And the tenor of the conversation, the most important thing was, can you say things that will stand up? Is there any possibility that what you say will be contradicted by the future release of facts, right? Because that's the one thing he can't survive.
Right. And that's the problem going forward, is that in these investigations, something's going to turn back towards him. He was contrite and sincere, et cetera, but the big problem for him is that his whole shtick is Mr. Get the Hell Off the Beach.
Yeah.
That's what people found endearing. I'm not sure endearing, but found refreshing about him, that he said what he thought and that he was sort of borderline bully.
Mm-hmm.
But now any of that kind of language that he uses just reminds you of this whole incident. Mm-hmm. So very hard for him going forward.
Teresa Kramer, are you surprised that this is as big a story as it is, or did it just leap out at you? I have to confess that when I first saw it, I was amused by the first stirrings of this story. It never occurred to me it would become the national media circus that it is now.
I guess, well, one of the things that surprised me about sort of the extent of this and the boldness of the people who actually did do this was that, you know, this inconveniences, I mean, this is thousands upon thousands upon thousands of people who cross this bridge every day. And to think that it, I mean, it just affected so many people. I don't know how it couldn't get huge.
Mm-hmm. What's your reaction to all this over there?
Well, I think there are a couple of reasons why it's this big, and one is what Teresa just alluded to, and that is traffic is one of the scourges of contemporary life, and nowhere more so than on the most used bridge in the world. Now, many issues are arcane, they're Byzantine, and people have difficulty grasping the small print of certainly of economics. Many of the problems that bewilder us most have to do with fiscal and economic policy. Nobody really understands that stuff. Everyone understands what it means to be caught in traffic. So I think half of the reason for this story's impact is that people have been there and they understand that road rage looms at every instant. And
yeah,
so
I don't know how the bridge is standing. Like, I just have no idea how.
So there's a capacity for the amplification of ever-ready road rage through these actions, something that everyone understands. But I think there's a more interesting side, and that is everyone also understands at some level the malicious, gleeful pleasure of being able to do this, to produce this kind of thing.
Exactly.
So when someone says, time for some traffic problems in Fort Lee, who among us does not have inside him or her a mischievous, impish, devilish troublemaker that would love to be the person who's able to say that and then, bam, do it.
Now I'm wondering which horrific mayor in Connecticut is behind all the inexplicable traffic on 95. That seems to
well,
absolutely
well, and
nowhere.
The reason I think Christie is in trouble is precisely because people understand that malicious pleasure. He's never going to escape the suspicion that he was either directly or certainly indirectly as a kind of inspiring maliciousness. It was behind that, freeing that impulse, which we all would love to do, but we don't. We restrain ourselves because we have to. They didn't, and you're going to pay a price for that for a long time.
Right. By the way, if you want to chime in on all this, 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. We have just a little clip yesterday from Chris Christie's press conference just to sort of remind you of the tone that he struck. Let's hear a little bit of the governor.
And I come out here today to apologize to the people of New Jersey. I apologize to the people of Fort Lee, and I apologize to the members of the state legislature. I am embarrassed and humiliated by the conduct of some of the people on my team.
The Dubey, it does strike me that he yesterday broke a couple more rules, I think. One of them is that, I mean, one of the phrases that he used, one of the sentences that he uttered was, I am not a bully. If I were working for a McDowell, Jewett, McEnroe Communications, one of the things that I would tell people is, remember Richard Nixon.
Exactly.
I am not a crook. Don't say the words.
Yes, exactly.
Don't say the words. Earlier this week, Governor Malloy said, I did not drive the state into a ditch. I would not have had – because people, you know, it's like talking to a German shepherd. They mainly hear – me drive state ditch. You know, that's about what they were. I bully. You don't want to say those words.
Well, Colin, Lowell Weicker had a phrase he would say occasionally when we members of the press corps would ask a question like that. Mm. You know, are you a bully? Did you intentionally XYZ? He would often say, your words, not mine.
Yeah.
Which I thought was a brilliant thing to say. First of all, it's not really quotable, so you're not going to use it. But he also, just as you said, was not going to repeat the negative phrase that a reporter had fed him. And I think you're right that, exactly, Richard Nixon, that soundbite could potentially be played over and over again in connection to Christie.
Some of the most effective moments, I thought, for him were ones where he was able to find and use some humor in an almost Hugh Grant-like way. Someone asked him at some point whether he would be commissioning any traffic studies in the near future, and he left. He said, I don't think that – I think I'm going to stay away from traffic studies for the foreseeable future. And everyone laughed, and it diffused something in a way that I think was helpful to him. The other comment I thought is worth looking at is at one point he said, you know, we all know – he was asked if he was a bully. He said, well, you know, we all know politics ain't beanbags. And then he moved on from that. He said, but I'm not a bully. And I think one of the, to me, big themes of this whole brouhaha is that there's been this uncovering of the way things really work. Mm. Now, look, we like to think, especially in NPR, mm-hmm. that politics amounts to a seminar-like discussion of competing ideas. And the best idea is the one that prevails, which governs, and by which we live. But we know that actually, the actuality of how politics is pursued involves the trading of favors, the use of cajoling, and, of course, the exercise of power. Power involves making people worry about you and be afraid of you at times. So there's a way in which, and when you hear that, time for some traffic problems in Fort Lee, you get the sense that, oh, now I'm hearing how a lot of things actually get done.
Well, this morning on Point, for all the true NPR fans out there, someone was saying, basically listed off all the times Chris Christie had very openly sort of used retribution against people in very small to sort of middling-sized ways, one of which was to take a judgeship away from a senator who had crossed him in some way. One was to just keep people out of political events, stuff like
that. Right, disinviting them in their own districts.
And so, at the very least, he has some culpability in building, you know, an environment in which this sort of thing is just sort of what you do when people make you mad.
And so, therefore, to be shocked
yes.
that this could happen, there's a ring of disingenuousness.
And there, you know, he says the woman he fired, I forget her name, but he says, I fired her because she lied to me. He doesn't say I fired her because she did a terrible thing. He says because people died. You know, he says she lied to me. If she had just been open about this, I would have probably, you know, given it the green light and it wouldn't have mattered.
Well, you go ahead.
Well, it's possible to have a rogue staffer who does something you don't know about and that is just off the charts bad. But, you know, a chief executive especially sets the tone for his or her office and staff. And a staffer is almost always going to think about what would the boss think about what I'm doing. And the fact that one of his high-ranking staff members could feel it was okay to send that text about traffic, time for some traffic problems, is going to, you know, live in infamy.
It just sounds like something Mr. Burns would say on The Simpsons.
Mm-hmm. Right,
you know,
right.
I mean, you don't want to say things like that. Well, yeah. We've covered political retaliation, and we've known retaliatory politicians, although it seems to me that there's sort of an algebra or an algorithm to this, which is also a little bit off, which is typically when they do this, when they retaliate, they will punish the one for the sins of the many, or they will punish the one for the sins of the one. But it's unusual to punish the many for the sins of the one. If, in fact, this was sort of the bargain, if, in fact, what the truth is that Chris Christie was very angry at the mayor of Fort Lee for not supporting him or endorsing him. And by the way, Rachel Maddow has floated a kind of alternative theory about what he might have been mad about. But it still would have amounted to being mad at one political leader. It's unusual to punish people who live in that town, people who don't live in that town but happen to be crossing that bridge at that particular moment. I mean, there is a sort of randomness to this. I mean,
It doesn't actually punish the mayor.
No, it doesn't really punish him. I mean, the closest thing to this that I can remember is when in 1992, and this wasn't really the result of anybody's malfeasance or unwillingness to do anything, but when Connecticut went for Jerry Brown in the primaries, after Bill Clinton got elected, there were persistent reports that Joe Lieberman, who was the coordinator really for Clinton, was the guy who was expected as a longtime Clinton ally and friend to deliver Connecticut. That Joe Lieberman, as a U.S. senator, could not get his calls returned from the White House. The Clintons, and it was more like that Darth Vader, you have disappointed me for the last time kind of thing. So and I guess in a sense, the people of Connecticut were being punished for something that Joe Lieberman had failed to deliver, or Joe Lieberman was being punished for something that the people of Connecticut had failed, or at least the Democratic voters of Connecticut had failed to do for Bill Clinton. But that's the last time I can remember anything quite like this. It's usually, you know, or you don't get your bond thing, you don't get your bonding thing approved. I just never heard anything like, we're going to stop traffic.
Yeah, it's real. I just don't understand. Yes. I said in our emails that I lived right below Fort Lee for a long time. I've spent more than my fair share of time in GW traffic. And on a normal day, it made me just want to drive off into the Hudson. It's horrible. But to 4 days of gridlock back. I don't know how the bridge is standing.
Go ahead. Let's hear how our governor, Dan Malloy, a frequent locker of horns with Governor Chris Christie, let's see what kind of high road he took about all this.
There is no doubt that a crime has been committed. Who it's been committed by remains to be seen. I'm aware that there is a legislative inquiry as well as a federal inquiry, federal prosecutor looking at it. I'm more than happy to take the governor at his word, but obviously this has a long way to go. I mean, let's be very clear. It's reported that at least 4 responses by ambulance services were substantially interrupted, that hundreds and hundreds of school children were prevented from getting to school in a timely fashion, that it caused a backup in traffic and therefore some accompanying loss of personal revenue or caused additional expense. All of that, apparently, over something that was quite trivial.
I want to hear your reaction, Rand, but sort of back to your earlier point about how some things are really, really complicated, you know, we've never had a successful prosecution of anybody connected to the 2008 collapse of our economy due to the credit default swaps, but we're going to have a prosecution over these traffic cones. But what do you?
Well, I find that response kind of remarkable. I mean, usually absent some ongoing vexed and litigation about, say, acid rain problems that cast one state against another, there tends to exist a sort of default, even across party lines, a sort of default understanding that one's fellow governors have a tough road to hoe. And so the instinct is usually to refrain, if at all possible, from gratuitous commentary on the travails of your neighboring governor. And so Malloy obviously feels that he had some score to settle here because he took that as far as he possibly could.
Though it used to be that previous governors of the state never commented on what the current governors are doing, and we have a previous governor on a AM station every day talking about the current.
Well, that's
one,
as you would say, a whole nother bridge with a horse of a different color on it. So I think
exactly.
We want to wait on that.
I did like Malloy said, you know, I take him at his word. I heard that phrase many, many times last night. Mm-hmm. The mayor of Fort Lee, I take the governor at his word, which is really code for I think the guy's lying.
Mm-hmm. One thing that Malloy's standard humorlessness about this brings, I think, up for us is that this is, in many ways, a funny. There's been a lot of humor generated by this from, like, you know, what the movie would be called, you know, A Bridge Too Far. and my favorite is from Jim Dwyer's column today in the Times, and he noted that they got the ethnicity of the mayor of Fort Lee wrong in calling him, that they were creating problems for that little Serbian.
Yeah.
He's actually of Croatian heritage. And, of course, as we know, those two ethnicities have been engaged in a very bloody battle for a long, long time. So Dwyer wrote that he called it the gang that couldn't slur straight.
That's good.
That's my favorite of the humor.
Speaking of that mayor, as I watched him last night on CNN, attractive person, well-spoken, all that I could think was that this mayor is going to be, you know, running for U.S. Senate, and that this guy, my prediction, is going to capitalize on this 15 minutes of fame in some way.
And he and Christie have already had a funny exchange. You know, Christie yesterday said, look, this guy wasn't even on my radar, claiming that he wouldn't have punished this guy. Subsequently, he had a conversation with the mayor, and the mayor said, well, am I on your radar now? And Christie said, you've got your own screen, which I thought was a pretty good line. But it sort of raises that question, too, Teresa. You know, if you're Chris Christie's handlers right now, you got to be thinking, this is the way to get the pin back in the grenade, I think. You got to get him on Saturday Night Live, tomorrow night, if you can, or somehow or other move this, because Christie can kind of do comedy. So you want to move him out into the field of comedy as fast as you can. You like this idea? You don't like this idea?
No. I like this idea because I think most of the, I mean, Christie supporters probably really don't care, right? Mm-hmm. They were just like, yeah, we liked him because he was loud and crazy. That's why we voted for him. And so to just put him out there more and more and make the people who had to sit in that traffic kind of forget about it a little bit and entertain them might work.
He should ceremonially walk across the bridge as a pedestrian.
Right. Well, have you seen the New Yorker cover that's coming out? It was just released today, and it's the artist Blit, I think, and he shows a group of cars that are at a standstill on the George Washington Bridge. And the reason that they're at a standstill is that there's Chris Christie as a little boy in short pants is running across chasing a ball that's kind of rolled in front of these in front of these cars. So, but that's how you do this these days. You know, you talked about Hugh Grant. I mean, one of the ways you rehabilitate yourself after a moment like this is to join the joke about yourself. And he would be well advised to do this.
I think one of the really unfortunate aspects of this, besides those people whose emergency vehicles may have been slowed down, is it just adds to the public's cynicism about government. I feel as though every time I come on this show, Colin, and talk to you, we have some story where we say the problem is that it makes people less eager to get involved in public service or makes them more cynical and they don't want to vote and think politicians are all corrupt. I mean, something like this, it's black and white what took place.
The last quick thing to explore here is, I mean, how many of you, I mean, to me, one of the problems for Christie yesterday is there isn't really a good interpretation of all this. Either he knew about this and he's now lying, or he created an atmosphere in which people thought this was okay to do because it was so much part and parcel of the overall atmosphere. And the only other possible explanation is that this one woman and the other Confederates who kind of were necessary for this completely fooled him, that, you know, that he has no stomach whatsoever for sociopaths, you know, but somehow or other this woman, whom I think he promoted four times, just absolutely deceived him as to the nature of her character.
Yep. Well, an article I read on Gawker sort of brought up the point of, like, what is the payoff for these staffers to do this if they're not getting points with the boss for it? Mm-hmm. Like, what? I he's already won at this point, so what? Why? And so it becomes a little harder to believe that he knows absolutely nothing about it.
Well, also because he's the type of person that he is, and so this hooks into pre-existing themes. Look, you can take presidents, for instance, and you can ask of any particular president, and this is really irrespective of party affiliation, does he seem and did he seem like the kind of person who would do this sort of thing? Jimmy Carter, no. Ronald Reagan, no. Richard Nixon, yes. And you can go on down the line. Gerald Ford, no. It's not a Democrat-Republican thing. It's what kind of person is this politician? And in that context, Christie would be a huge yes. Mm-hmm. It dovetails with so many things that we already have heard and understand about. And indeed, with his public persona, in which he frequently takes on interlocutors with this, you know, bellicose dismissiveness, that's part of his appeal. Mm-hmm. So part of what makes him appealing to many people is also a potential weakness. That weakness has been brought out in the most glaring contrast by these events, and that's why it's liable to stick.
I would vote that he didn't know, but he created the atmosphere where doing that kind of thing, abusing power in that way, isn't this fun? We'll put on the sirens and flashers to, you know, go to Dunkin' Donuts and, you know, beat the traffic, that kind of thing was okay to do, and that this woman who had become, I don't want to say, well, I guess, you know, become accustomed to carrying things out this way, felt she could do it.
You know, I just, what Rand said made me realize that there really kind of are, I think at least I've seen two different kinds of political leaders at the level of governor and president. Typically, there's either a sort of Jimmy Carter kind of person, you know, basically kind of nice, reflective kind of person who, in that case, has to have a sociopathic hatchet person pretty close at hand to do all the stuff that this person will not do. And then the other kind of person is the sociopathic bully as governor, who also has to have a hatchet person to do all the things that he wants to do. But I don't think I've ever seen the administration where both the leader himself or herself and the chief of staff were both incredibly nice people who were incapable of this kind of activity. Let me just grab one quick call. We do have to move on. We've got polygamy and incandescent light bulbs, although not necessarily in a linked fashion, to talk about here today. Here's Tim from Bethany. Hi, Tim.
Hi, guys. I think people will find out later on that the intent of this was not the mayor, but some of the assembly people from Fort Lee. And we're kind of, you know, look at this hand, but don't look at this hand over here. He's been in tremendous fights with the General Assembly, and that's one of the things. But I would like to say that, you know, we don't, as people know, this affected Connecticut, too, because I spoke with many people you know, for 4 days, people lost money in Connecticut, the deliveries, people could not get back in time. I mean, this was, you know, tying up an interstate like this. I think you're going to find eventually some criminal intentions. I think people have said that, I mean, criminal charges coming out of doing this. And I think, you know, just on the bold fact, people know that after 1 day, if there's a traffic study, like, but it's causing this much damage, you pull it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, 4 days later.
Well, yeah,
you know,
I think the traffic study theory has now exploded. I mean, I think that one's sort of gone. Anyway, I do feel as though if this is a crime, you know, somewhere Tony Soprano is turning over in his grave. You know, really, this is crime in New Jersey? Crime used to be crime. Now it's just traffic jams. All right, we have to take a break. We'll be back after this. All right, we're back, and we're doing the nose. And with us is Dubi McDowell from McDowell Jewett Communications, Teresa Kramer from The Cut, an online magazine exploiting and celebrating Connecticut's ridiculousness, and Rand Cooper, who likes to exploit and celebrate Connecticut's ridiculous too, but in other contexts, although he may be a guest columnist on The Cut for all I know this month. All right, so we just got through with Chris Christie. No more phone calls about that, but if you do want to call in as we talk about the next thing, 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. Actually, the next two topics were suggested by Rand, so I'm going to make him kick this one off a little bit. This is kind of works off a page one story a couple of days ago in the New York Times about the Brown family. They have a reality TV show on the TLC network, which used to stand for the Learning Channel. It can't possibly still mean that anymore. anyway, they have a show called Sister Wives. It's about their polygamous arrangement. Meanwhile, they were also in court about their polygamous arrangement. Last month, a federal judge partly overturned the ban on polygamy, ruling that prohibiting cohabitation violates the First Amendment guarantee of free exercise of religion. So, Rand, why is this so interesting to you?
Well, the short version that we can discuss and readers and listeners can certainly call in on is, are we headed for a thumbs up legally and culturally to polygamy after so many years, centuries really, of suppressing it? So this topic is interesting to me in a couple of bases. And one is, what is interest and curiosity about the nature and the workings of a polygamous family? So that's point one that we could discuss. But the other is, it takes me back to debates about same-sex marriage. And over the years, people who have had doubts about legalizing gay marriage have sometimes said, well, if we legalize gay marriage, what about polygamy? Often those arguments were considered by many to be mischievous, disingenuous, troublemaking, or insulting. The idea being, well, that will never happen. That's not going to happen. And now, well, it seems to be happening. So the question is, on what basis do we, if we do, continue the project of asserting any kind of normative basis for what constitutes marriage, both culturally and legally? That was really the impetus behind those questions initially. One response is to say, you know what, we're not going to do that at all. Anyone can be married, it's an individual right. It's a private set of preferences, and what right do we have as a culture and as a society, legally or in any other way, to proscribe arrangements among consenting adults? So then, these questions continue to ramify. Well, then, if polygamy, what about polyandry? Colin and I years ago interviewed a woman from the polyamory from the Polyamory Society, and she was involved in sort of shifting coalitions of men and women who were sort of all married in a team-like fashion.
But not actually seeking the covenant.
But how about then polyamorous marriages? So I'm interested in this point, both in sort of the content of polygamous marriage, but also the project and the challenge for us as a society to seek and give the imprimatur to, in a normative way, to this arrangement and not that one.
Our number, by the way, 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. I have lots of reactions to this, and it's something that Rand and I have debated about a lot among ourselves or between ourselves. Well, yes.
Let's hear from you.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, first of all, what are the? I think there's a little bit of a post hoc, proctor hoc fallacy to what Rand is saying right now, which is, I mean, I'm not really sure that these two things are particularly linked. Certainly the reasoning of the federal court on this has nothing to do with gay marriage and everything to do with religious freedom. And to me, whenever Rand would bring this up in the past, I always call it my pet term for it is the cannibal argument, which is, you know, whatever kind of social change you're talking about, sooner or later someone will say, well, what about cannibals? You know, how about when they want that too? And I always say, you know, I'm actually able to distinguish between cannibals and the thing we're talking about right now.
So Rick Santorum he would then say man on dog or something.
Right, exactly.
Like that.
You know, and to me, that's the cannibal argument. I mean, it's and the answer is I am capable of thinking about these two things completely separately, and whatever it is, that's how I felt and feel about polygamous marriage and gay marriage, that those are completely different things, and I can think about them separately. And I'm not really sure. I mean, I know what you're saying, and it's certainly. I mean, one of the things I do believe is that if you're looking for social change on a front like this one, and somebody gives you a choice between a favorable federal court decision and a hit reality TV show, take the second one, because that is going to make a much bigger difference. And I do believe that anyway, that in the court of public opinion, having this series where people get to see them being as incredible, as far as I can. Have you ever watched this show?
I have seen the show, actually. Yeah, there's Big Love, and then there's this show, and he's very much the Bill Paxton, and somewhere out there are the creepy compound nuts. And so they're likable and it's one of those shows that makes you think that the women actually have it pretty good in this situation, because they have basically built-in support all the time, and he has three wives who are yelling at him all the time. And I mean, they're kind of weird and kooky, but they're likable.
Yeah. I mean, in some ways, what little of it I've watched, it struck me as kind of like a fairly boring life that they're having.
It
so
really is.
We got a tweet sort of to my point from Slossnug. I think it says, polygamy flows very easily from hetero marriage. Please don't blame the gays. And he has a point. It's kind of like you start letting people get heterosexually married pretty soon, you know, before you know it, they're going to want to.
Well, but that's actually that's fine. My point is not that, we shouldn't have allowed same-sex marriage. Mm-hmm. I mean, my point really addresses the prospect of giving an imprimatur of approval to any, including straight marriage, to any arrangement and not to others, in a society that increasingly sees individual rights as the sine qua non of any of any legal imprimatur. So, Colin, when
you're doing
a
lot of Latin here,
but to challenge you a little bit, you say you're capable of viewing these things differently. But doesn't that simply reflect a different value and different valuation on your part? That doesn't speak to the social and legal prospect and project of deciding one. You can simply say, "Yeah, I value one over the other." Well, that's fine. But what does that say about what we do actually with our laws?
Yeah, and I didn't really say that I valued one over the other; just that I was capable of thinking about them separately. At the level of law, it's going to be a mess.
Yeah.
One of us here is married to a judge who I'm sure is dreading this. Not that he really does this kind of thing. But I mean, in other words, imagine, think of all the problems that exist now around, say, hospital visitation and end-of-life decisions and stuff like that in just sort of two-person couples of any kind. And that now imagine somebody with three wives. You know, imagine that. I mean, that's just one of about 20 or 25 permutations that you could pretty easily think of how this could turn into an incredible mess.
And that's just with three wives. There are dudes out there with like 12 of them. So,
I mean, I actually am probably the only one here who's had a very good friend who's from a polygamous family. Mm-hmm. I lived for 3 years in East Africa, and my dearest friend there was the son of a man who had three wives. 23 children altogether. They lived all in the village where I was living. I was vastly curious about how this worked, how in God's name this worked. And I spent a good deal of time paying attention to it. But you know, decades later, for me, it's easy for me to categorize, okay, that was something that was that belonged to a culture that I was visiting as an outsider. It had grown up in that culture over many hundreds of years. It made sense. It was sort of like a local flora and fauna. And to transport that, I mean, for people to simply start saying, in our culture, where it doesn't have much roots aside from that one particular strand of Mormonism, mm-hmm. to suddenly start opting for it. Well, in fact, by the way, there's no sign that anyone is opting for mm-hmm. it mm-hmm. outside of a very, very small a group of a very small subculture. So probably this whole problem is not likely to arise on a massive basis.
I wonder if the real question is not whether or not we actually legalize polygamy, but whether it continues to be criminalized in the form that it's being practiced by people like the Browns, which is he's not legally married to his two or three other wives, whatever there are. He's just kind of shacking up with them and having kids with them. And as far as I'm concerned, I mean, how's that any different from a guy who just has a separate life with another family? It's not except that his wives know about it, and there doesn't seem anything criminal.
I was just going to say, I got a little distracted leading up to this program because I just kept thinking how unfair it seems that it's always men mm-hmm. who get to have the multiple spouses, which led me into a little bit of research of polyandry. Mm. A word I didn't know before, but it sounds like Rand and Colin, who have spent an inordinate amount of time thinking about multiple spouses.
That was just a journalistic responsibility of Colin.
We took a walk on the wild side.
Oh, okay. Well, anyway, it just seems that there are cultures where polyandry and a woman having more than one spouse, I mean, do exist, but we got the short end of the stick, and it's usually two brothers sharing a wife or a woman, two brothers, because you don't want the land to be disseminated out to too many different strands. So you end up keeping needless to say, there are not many instances of this. So, as I said, I just kind of wandered off into that area in my research, and maybe I'll just start a polyandry society of some sort.
The one thing that I would say about this is that I think one thing you can't assume anymore is that something that's currently a small subculture and not very contiguous to the rest of life is going to stay that way. The world is getting smaller all the time, and we're encountering one another in all kinds of ways all the time. So the idea that one's daughter attending Wellesley right now would never be in a position to suddenly be one of three wives of an East African Muslim man might have been a pretty safe assumption 25 years ago, but I don't think it is now. I think things like that do happen and will happen, and so stay tuned. Very quickly here, just so we'll have time, another thing suggested by Rand, so he'll have to lead off again, is that we're coming to the end of the life of the traditional incandescent bulb. And, in fact, I'll let you sort of take over because this apparently is a...
This is a story that everyone has this category of story. You're sort of paying attention to it in the background but not really paying attention to it, and then suddenly... you can't get a light bulb anymore. Mm-hmm. And this happened to me in recent months when I would go to the Walgreens and, where's my 100-watt light bulb? And then it would kick in dimly. I've been reading for 5 years that this was coming. And yet here it is. And now I read in the paper, I understand we really have entered the last flickering moments of the incandescent light bulb.
First they came for the 100-watt bulbs, then the 75-watt bulbs. Now it's 60 and 40.
Right. And so very soon, we're not going to be able to get the 60s and 40s. We're only going to be able to get the various...
How soon? Because I might run out to the store.
The various new alternatives that are there. And I have to say, I feel sadness. Mm. And that's not just because I tend to resist. My default position is resist all change and try to keep things as they were, when one was young. That is my position. But in this case, I feel there are other reasons. The incandescent bulb not only has a different quality of light than any of these Arivist interloping models that are now available to us, it has a softer, it has a more golden glow, and it is in that glowing filament. It connects us in ways that the new lights do not, to fire and to heat itself. And it also connects us directly to the work and life of Thomas Edison. Mm. And all of that, I mean, this is my valedictory to the incandescence of this device, includes all that, and also includes my complete unwillingness ever to pay $14 for a light bulb, even if I'm told it's going to outlive me.
Well, the price is falling now. I mean, you go to Home Depot and get a big bulb.
But there are some bulbs, like one of these bulbs is going to last for 40 years. I think you pay like $64 for it. It's guaranteed to outlive you. I do not want a light bulb to outlive me. I resent a light bulb that will outlive me, and I refuse to pay $64 for that.
Other quarters wanting to be heard from?
Well, this is funny. It comes up now because I've been thinking about this recently because I was a big proponent of the CFL, and they're all in most of my light fixtures. And I've got and now it's to the point that we're in, like, my dining room. Maybe only two of them are actually screwed all the way in, and, like, three of them are not because they're just too bright and caustic. And so I can't deal with it. And so I've been thinking about replacing them with low wattage incandescent bulbs because I so rarely use that light fixture anyway. It's really not costing me anything. And so now I'm in a bit of a panic, and I'm going to have to run out to Target after this.
And get bread and milk, too, just in case there's a storm.
Alan, do you like the tubular shape of those? It looks like soft serve ice cream. Mm-hmm. It looks like something unmentionable. I don't like the shape of it.
Although you're really from, yeah, what were you going to say, Jim?
Turning this into a complete home improvement show, we have had a dimmer light, and we put in one of the new bulbs.
It won't dim.
It won't dim,
they do
damn it.
They do make dimmable ones.
Yeah, they do exist.
Yeah, you just have to look for
okay. Good to know. I feel better.
I mean, at the level of energy consumption, though, this really is, I mean, the incandescent bulb is about as close as you can get to turning on your stove and the burners in your range to make your house warm. I mean, I'm aware of that, and I know this is NPR. It's 5% of its energy use actually goes to lighting up, and the rest of it doesn't. The rest of it's
we're shivering in a 52-degree room right now, and I know that's fully in accord with NPR's priorities, and so is the shift away from this light bulb. Nevertheless, when I was in fifth grade, I wrote a report on the life of Thomas Alva Edison.
Aww.
And on October 18th, 1931, he died. He had been ill. His wife left a light bulb in the window of their house because people had been gathering outside. She said, when he dies, I will turn the light off. I ended my report with, at 10 p.m. on October 18th, the light went out. It was my first understanding and use of metaphor. I'm so way into the incandescent light bulb. I will never give it up. I'm hoarding them. I have 50 of them.
Because of the moment you have a cane, too, this really does, you really are getting pretty close to the...
Shake it.
Get
now.
Off my lawn, you kids and your iPods. All right.
This is sort of like you and your Mary Poppins
it is.
Thing.
It is.
Which you'll get into another time.
Another time. We got to take a break. We'll come back with endorsements.
Tell me why goes out to anyone that has lost something that they truly love. Check it out. Seemed like yesterday we used to rock the show. I flipped the switch, you rocked the glow. So far from being only luminescent, notoriously incandescent. But looks ain't always what they seem to be. Congress taking you away from me. New bulb costs like 10 times more. Need a hazmat crew when it hits the floor.
Come on, Bernie. Wake up. Look at me, Bernie. Stay with me, Bernie. Please. I used one of those compact fluorescent bulbs as a heat source for my snake tank, and now my python Bernie is in a coma. Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me. Our intern is Katie Pikus. Greg Hill appeared in our intro and tweets for us at WNPR Colin. The part of Bill Curry was played by Bill Paxton. For articles, links, photos, and videos of the Faith Middleton Show staff trying to make balsamic braised pancetta glazed lentil walnut apple loaf in an easy bake oven with a compact fluorescent bulb, visit our website, WNPR.org. On Monday, it's the scramble, and the world will never be the same after the Golden Globes. And now, back to Colin.
All right, so we're gonna, apropos of polyandry, Steve, somebody named Steve tweets, I would rather have co-husbands. Four guys in the house, play cards. Four wives, fight club. That's just one person's opinion. All right, it's time, if possible, we might be able to grab Jim from Southbury towards the end of the show, but it is time for endorsements when our panelists tell you about things that they know about that perhaps you'd enjoy. Teresa Kramer, what have you got for us?
Well, on my way here, I was listening to Julian Fellows on... whatever that show is that comes on before this.
Fresh Air.
Yeah. And so I thought I would endorse for the Downton Abbey crowd a show called Monarch of the Glen that you can watch on Netflix. And Julian Fellowes stars in it as like a sort of crazed lord named Kill Willie who lives out in...
He's the writer is actually the writer of Downton Abbey,
but he's also an actor, and he starred in this other show that's sort of about more modern estate life in Scotland, and he plays sort of the kooky neighbor named Kill Willie.
Right. How many wives does the monarch have?
He has just one, right. Just the one.
Does he have a child named Honey Boo Boo? Honey McBooBoo, something like that.
No, right? But he's got a lot of dogs, right. And he shoots things a lot.
Mm-hmm. Monarch of the Glen, all right.
Monarch of the Glen.
All right. Mm-hmm. Doobie, what have you got?
I will endorse the book The Circle by Dave Eggers, even though it's not his best work and it's not a perfect book. It's well written and gives you a sense, since it's about sort of a fictional company a la Facebook, a sense of what the world could be like if an internet behemoth were to essentially take over our lives. And also Bully Pulpit by Doris Kearns Goodwin. Mm-hmm. Just for those who like history even a little bit, just a world in which soft glow light bulbs. Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft. It's a wonderful book.
All right. So, what have you got?
I'm going to be literary, too. I'd like to direct listeners to the novels of one of America's most underappreciated, celebrated writers, and that is Alice MacDermot. She, her subject has been the lives of Irish Americans and the Irish American diaspora, mostly in New York City over the past 50 years. She's written, I think, 6 or 7 novels, the best of which, in my view, is her second novel, written in the late 90s, called That Night. It's written well before that. But it's a Romeo and Juliet story. It takes place on Long Island. It's about a gang of guys who are involved in a gang fight centering on a romance between two teenagers. Second one is Charming Billy, which is essentially a 250-page account of an Irish funeral and all the Irish-American funeral and all the storytelling that goes on there. And then her current book is called Someone, and it follows the life of a Brooklyn woman over the course of 60 years, starting in the 30s and going into her tenth decade of life. And it's about the family relations, the loss of siblings and parents, mental illness, the challenges of marriage and raising kids. It's one of these books which, although it's only 250 pages long, is about everything. She's an unusually self-effacing seeming writer, but her narratives are sort of circuitously strange and very, very beautiful. It's a deeply, deeply felt accounts of the inner lives of 20th century Americans.
Well, it's literary day here on the endorsements because I'm going to endorse a book, too. I am very late to this party. I'm late to all book parties these days, I guess. I am just absolutely entranced by Jennifer Egan's Pulitzer Prize-winning book, A Visit from the Goon Squad, which, as Rand knows, I read books now at the gym on a recumbent bicycle at the gym. And this book has moments in it. It happened to me today. I'm coming towards the end of the book, but it happened to me today where something so remarkable happened in the book, something in a horrible way remarkable, that I just sort of threw the book down and thumped my chest and went, oh, no, that's so wrong, as people around me at the gym, stared at me. But this is it's funny. It, to give a quick sense of it, it's very episodic. It's a set of linked characters, kind of more or less situated loosely within the world of rock and roll and the people who produce rock and roll and who are representatives and publicists and stuff like that. And it's certainly there is a subplot in that completely anticipates Dennis Rodman's adventures in North Korea recently. There is a publicist who has to figure out how to make a genocidal dictator look better or look more acceptable to the rest of the world. So anyway, that is A Visit from the Goon Squad. I'm sure all the rest of you already read it. I'm endorsing something that I'm the last person to find out about. But and very quickly, I just want to mention, and I'm going to start mentioning it a lot, on the January 22nd, we'll be reviving our freshly squeezed series at Watkinson School. This is January 22nd. The program is The Healing Power of Music. Two musicians that you probably know pretty well if you listen to this station, Jim Chapdelaine and Kate Callahan, each of whom overcame medical issues through, or at least using music as a big part of that, will be there, as will be a musical therapist and a neuroscientist to talk about, in fact, what is known, what's understood about the way that music can be used to address medical situations. So anyway, join us. This is open to the public. January 22nd. Put it on your calendar. We'll be telling you more.
I'm Kyone Wolf. How many public radio hosts does it take to screw in an incandescent light bulb? None. They don't exist anymore. The incandescent light bulbs are not around. The public radio hosts are still here.